Okay. So everyone has the pages, I hope. Somebody asked me to announce the text that we're going to be using is Halachic Man from Rav Soloveitchik. I think you could get it on Amazon or in your local Orthodox Jewish bookstore. Okay. So last week we had an introductory class where we spoke about the method and, more correctly stated, the motive of Rav Soloveitchik in the Sefer, which is essentially a phenomenological work where Rav Soloveitchik is going to discuss the experience of consciousness, the structure of our consciousness, of what it means to be a Jew, the conscious state that a Jew is supposed to have, the way we're supposed to experience life. And we discussed that that is very much comes from the Rav's philosophical bend, which is towards the school of the Neo-Kantian school of philosophy, which began the turn to the subjective, to the subject as opposed to the object, that all we could ever really know is our subjective world, what goes on inside ourselves. That's what we could only know, and therefore that has to be the focus of our life, the focus of our philosophy, the focus of our study. And what we spoke about, based on other sources in Judaism and Chassidus, is that not only is what goes on inside oneself, not only will it change a person's life, not only does it change a person, as we spoke about from the Maharal, we spoke about Vayotze Oisei Achutza, that it takes a person out of who he was until now, but it actually has a metaphysical effect on the world. And that also comes from Kant, that a person's subjective experience, that what goes on inside my consciousness, what goes on inside my heart and mind, affects the world. It actually changes the world. And the truth of Mashiach, the truth of ultimate reality, and the truth of what Chassidus says and what Rav Soloveitchik is also suggesting with his work, is that based on what goes on inside our personalities, our subjective personalities, that essentially changes and brings about the ultimate redemption of the objective world, the objective reality itself. So today we're going to begin actually learning the work. And again, that is the theme, as I spoke about last week, and we're going to come up on a lot of times we're going to stumble upon it. We're going to speak about it a lot and dissect it a lot more, but that was the general idea we spoke about last time. So let's open up the actual text. Now, you have the pages. We're starting with the page that says on it, part one, Halachic Man, His Worldview and His Life. You should have two pages in front of you. The page, the title page that says on it, Halachic Man, His Worldview and His Life. They're both two-sided, so on the left side of the page, you see that before Rav Soloveitchik actually begins the work, so on the left side, you see that he has a quote from the Gemara in Seita. Again, I see some people who are on the title page that says in it, Halachic Man, His Worldview and His Life, okay? So on that page, on the left side, you see that before he actually begins, he quotes a Gemara from Seita. And the Gemara from Saiti quotes, at that moment, the image of his father came to him and appeared before him in the window. At that moment, the image of his father came to him and appeared before him in the window. So, who remembers what's that speaking about? Yosef and Yaakov, right. You all remember the story in Genesis 36, where Yosef is about to do an aver. Joseph is about to do a sin with the wife of Potiphar. He came back to the house, Potiphar's house, to do a sin. And when he was about to do a sin, at that moment, that's the Gemara that's Sota that's being quoted over here, and Rashi brings it in Chumash, that at that moment, the image of his father came before him and appeared to him in the window. And that's what stopped him from being able to do the sin. And the Torah says that Yosef, when he saw that, Vayonas Vayetze Echutzi, he left his garment in the hand of Potiphar's wife, his jacket that she grabbed onto, and he ran outside. Vayonas v'yitzei chutz, he ran outside. So why does Rav Soloveitchik begin with this quote? So obviously, what's he referring to here? On the obvious thing, which he seems to be talking about, is his father, of course, right? Soloveitchik, of course, is making reference here, a simple pshat over here, to his father, Rav Moshe. Rav Soloveitchik was a Jew who was not afraid to tackle the world. He was not afraid to take on the world. And he was part of the world. That was his shita, that was his ideology, as we mentioned last week. Rav Soloveitchik was not one that believed in rebuilding ghetto walls, metaphysical ghetto walls. Rav Soloveitchik very much believed in engaging the world. And so to speak, what's being seems to be conveyed in this quote over here is Rav Soloveitchik is sort of making a salute to his father by saying that it was his father's image that guided him and that shielded him throughout his life. The image of his father is what shielded him and guided him throughout his life to be able to remain faithful and loyal. You know, by the way, this is a source. There is such an inyan, it's brought in the Sfarma Kadoshim and the Holy Sfarma and the works of Kabbalah, etc. There is such an inyan of picturing the face of a tzaddik. The inyan of picturing the face of one's father. I don't know if all of us could say that that will necessarily stop us all from sinning. Depends who your father is, right? Depends who your parent is. But there's an inyan of picturing one's father's face or a tzaddik's face. And this is the source that it actually says that this gave Yosef the ability to overcome the sin. To overcome the sin and not do the sin. By the way, just to say parenthetically, there's an absolutely astounding letter. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zecher Tzaddik Levracha, of blessed memory, when right a couple years after he became Rebbe, so a woman wrote to him that she was having issues with anxiety. She was having issues with anxiety. She was having illogical, anxious impulses. She was afraid. She was having scared all the time. A terrible fear fell upon her all the time. She was really experiencing horrible anxiety. So there's a letter, it's a handwritten, the Rebbe wrote to her like this, that she should take a picture of the previous Rebbe, of my father-in-law, take a picture of him, and you should look at it. And then he says, V'yedan, she should know, you should know, that because my father-in-law was a true shepherd of the Jewish people, a true tzaddik, I was just recently over the weekend, I was with somebody that asked me that seemingly a tzaddik, after a tzaddik passes away from this world, why should the tzaddik want to have anything to do with us over here in this world? Seemingly a tzaddik shouldn't want, why do we go to the gravesites of tzaddikim? The tzaddik shouldn't want to have anything to do with people in this world. And the answer is, Roi Yisrael Amita Layazu Tzon Marisim. True shepherds don't leave their flock even after they pass away. So the Rebbe wrote her, she should look at the picture, V'ye Teda, you should know, that since my father-in-law was a true shepherd of the Jewish people, he's looking at you also at that same time. V'yoyel is, and it's going to help the anxiety go away. So we know, you know, obviously we don't know what happened afterwards, but we could assume, I guess, it did, right? But that's the idea of looking at the face of a tzaddik. So if Soloveitchik is writing over here, because that was his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and of course you all understand that Rav Soloveitchik is writing this, he was the halachic man par excellence, right? It's always understood that when he's writing halachic man and he's modeling the book on the ultimate halachic man, he was speaking about his father, Rav Moshe. So even before we go further, I just want to share with you, just to get a sense of who Rav Moshe was, because again, if Rav Soloveitchik is writing this as the entrance way to understand this book, Halachic Man. So, to get a better sense of who he was, Rav Moshe, and the effect that he had on the Rav, the effect as a father, and even deeper, you know, you could have a father that's a biological father, and you could have a father that's an educator, a father who is an educator. To see the effect that Rav Moshe had on the Rav, so I want to read with you a piece that he wrote in another work of his that was actually just translated into English not too long ago, called the Bikashta Misham. It's another book of Rav Soloveitchik, and from there you shall seek. So this book is also, you know, when I told the Rabbi Weinberg, when I told Rebbe that I want to give a show on Halachic Man, so he said, why don't I go straight to From There You Shall Seek? Why do we go, you know, so From There You Shall, so I told Rabbi Weinberg, I said, you know, I don't know people here well enough to get that emotional yet. This Sefer, From There You Shall Seek, is extremely emotional, extremely, you know, so... maybe we'll get to it one day. But over here, in this, towards the end of the book, he writes over here to explain the idea of Mesorah, to explain the idea of the transmission of Torah. And again, I'm sharing it with you not just haphazardly, because again, Rav Soloveitchik is writing at the beginning of Halachic Man, he's putting in this reference to this Gemara, seemingly to say how his father's image stood before him at all times, and that's what shielded him, that's what allowed him, that's what facilitated him to be able to survive throughout all his engaging of this world. So to get a glimpse of who this Rav Moshe was, and to understand again how this whole shita, the whole ideology of this book, which is to shape one's consciousness, right? We spoke about last week, this book is not just about lamaisa, what do I do, X, Y, and Z. This book is about reshaping our hearts and minds. So listen how he relates what it meant, what he grew up with this Reb Moshe Soloveitchik with his father. So Soloveitchik writes like this: I would like to relate a personal experience to illustrate the idea of the Mesorah. What does it mean to really transmit Torah? I remember myself as a child, a lonely, forlorn boy. I was afraid of the world that seemed cold and alien. I felt as if everyone were mocking me. See how sensitive he was even as a child, right? Anyone that was sensitive had those periods of thinking that everyone is mocking you, right? The people that are able to always, you know, stand up to the world like Popeye at all times and never feel intimidated by it are those that are not sensitive. But I had one friend. Even when the world was cold and alien, says Rav Soloveitchik, I had one friend. One friend. And he was, please don't laugh at me, Maimonides, the Rambam. How did we become friends? We simply met. The Rambam was a regular guest in our house. Those were the days when my father, my mentor, was still living in the home of my grandfather, Rabbi Leo Feinstein of Pruzhna. Father sat and studied Torah day and night. A rather small group of outstanding young Torah scholars gathered around him and imbibed his words thirstily. Father's lectures were given in my grandfather's living room, where my bed was placed. Imagine that's where he slept, right? I used to sit up in bed and listen to my father talk. My father always spoke about the Rambam. This is how he would proceed. He would open a volume of the Talmud and read a passage. Then he would say, this is the interpretation of Rashi and the other Bali Tosfos, the Tosafists. Now let's see how the Rambam interpreted the passage. Father would always find how the Rambam differed in its interpretation and deviated from the simple way. My father would say, almost as a complaint against the Rambam, we don't understand our master's reasoning or the way he explains the passage. It was as if he was complaining against the Rambam directly. Rabbeinu Moshe, why did you do this? My father would then say, first and foremost, the criticisms and the objections of the Ravid are actually correct. He would take the side of the Ravid and those that argued on the Rambam, those that argued on Maimonides, and say they seem to be correct when they're arguing on the Rambam. The members of the group would jump up and each of them would suggest an idea. Father would listen and rebut their ideas and then repeat, our master's words are as hard to crack as iron. But he would not despair. He would rest his head on his fist and sink into deep thought. The group was quiet and did not disturb his reflections. After a long while, he would lift his head very slowly and begin, Rabbeisai, let's see. And he would start to talk. Sometimes he would say a great deal, other times only a little. I would strain my ears and listen to what he was saying. I did not understand anything at all about the issue under discussion, but two impressions were formed immediately in my young, innocent mind. Number one, the Rambam was surrounded by opponents and enemies who want to harm him. Right? He got the feeling that the Rambam had enemies that wanted to harm him. No, you all remember the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Chav Ches, the famous Gemara over there in Brachos, when the showdown between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, right? When Rabbi Gamliel lost his position as the head of the Sanhedrin, they had Tyre Belezer ben Azariah. You remember that whole showdown over there, that discussion. How were the Rabbanim, the rabbis, referred to over there in the Gemara? Anyone remember when Rabbi Akiva says to Rabbi Yeshua, let's wait until the, who will enter the Beis Medrash? Huh? The Bali Trisin, the warriors. A tris is a shield, right? The warriors. Let's wait for the warriors to enter the Beis Medrash. The Balei Trisin, that's way to the warriors. Anyone that's never been to a Beis Medrash, a yeshiva, if you take, you know, some unknowing, you know, Gentile in the street and you put him into, like, you know, Beis Medrash in Ponyvich or something, he would think it's either an insane asylum, right? Or it's Pashat, you know, the people hate each other. The yelling and screaming that goes on, if you've never seen it, it could be very scary. I must admit, I had a chavrusa when I was in Eretz Yisrael, I remember who it was. He asked me to, like, back down. Like, I was a little too violent. I got a little too intense for him. I yelled a little too much. But, you know, you've seen it, basically, people yelling and getting involved in Rischa der Isa, right, in the anger of Torah, yelling and screaming, take it personally. Of course, like, where does that come from? It comes from because it's important to you, because it's meaningful to you, right? I always say, you know, it's always when you have people, like, complain against religious Jews and Orthodox and rabbis. You hear a lot of times the complaint, why do all these rabbis, everyone has a different ideology, and there's so many different arguments, and this one says this way, and this one has this ideology, and there's so much, like Rodney King, why can't we all just get along? Right? Why can't we all just get along? Jews were all everyone. So what's this arguing back and forth? And I remember as a kid growing up in the Young Israel of Woodmere, I'll never forget. This was when I was growing up, it was the early 80s. And then when I was a small kid in the early 80s, this is when Lubavitch and Satmar were this is when they were having the dance of death. Lubavitch and Satmar were still, hand-to-hand combat. So I remember sitting in the Young Israel of Woodmere. And I don't know if they still do this, but when I was a kid, they used to talk there in the middle of davening. They probably stopped already. But I remember sitting there as a little kid, and I heard a couple of people, it's the old sanctuary. It's not there anymore. It used to be built in there when they had this rose over there in the back. So they were saying these Satmar and the Lubavitch, they keep fighting. What's all the fighting? We have to argue. Why do you have to argue so much? What's it to argue so much about? It's a Seder. It's the arguing. And then whatever, a few minutes passed. And then they started talking about the World Series. So Halacha L'maaseh, yeah? You should have seen the arguing that was going on. I don't remember who was playing. But the arguing, they started getting such a heated argument. I'm like, and these same people, a minute before they were ranking on, the Chassidim that they're fighting. And then they started getting to screaming match about, I don't remember, the Yankees, whatever it was. Right? Because what do you get upset about? What do you get heated up about? When it's relevant to you. When you care. When it's something that's meaningful to you. So it works you up. It gets you involved. You want to argue. So Soloveitchik says that he was listening to his father, so he knew two things when his father was dealing with the Rambam. Number one, the Rambam was surrounded by opponents, warriors, and enemies who want to harm him. And number two, his only defender was my father. If not for my father, who knew what would happen to the Rambam? Who knew? I felt that the Rambam himself was present in the living room, listening to what my father was saying. The Rambam was sitting with me on my bed. What did he look like? I didn't know exactly, but his countenance resembled my father's good and beautiful face. He had the same name as my father, Moshe. Father would speak, the students, their eyes fixed on him, would listen intently to what he was saying. Slowly, slowly, the tension ebbed. Father strode boldly and bravely. New arguments emerged. Halachic rules were formulated and defined with wondrous precision. A new light shone. The difficulties were resolved. The passage was explained. The Rambam emerged the winner. Father's face shone with joy. He had defended his friend. Rabbeinu Moshe, the son of Maimon. A smile of satisfaction appeared on the Rambam's lips. I too participated in this joy. I was happy and excited. I would jump out of bed and run to my mother's room and tell her the joyful news. Mother, mother, the Rambam is right. He defeated the Ravid. Father came to his aid. How wonderful father is. He says, but occasionally, listen to this. But occasionally, the Rambam's luck did not hold. His enemies attacked him on all sides. The difficulties were as hard as iron. Father was unable to follow the logic of his position. He tried with all his might to defend him, but he was unsuccessful. Father would sink into musings with his head leaning on his fists. The students and I, even the Rambam himself, would tensely wait for father's answer. But father sometimes would pick up his head and say, the answer will have to wait till Eliyahu HaNavi, till the prophet Elijah. What the Rambam says is too difficult. There is no expert who can explain it. The issue remains in need of clarification. The whole group, my father included, were sad to the point of tears. A silent agony expressed itself on each face. Tears came from my eyes too, and I could even see bright teardrops in the Rambam's eyes. Slowly I would go to my mother, and I would tell her with a broken heart, Mother, Father can't resolve the Rambam. What should we do? Don't be sad, my mother would answer. Father will find the solution for the Rambam. And if he doesn't find one, maybe when you grow up, you'll resolve his words. The main thing is to learn Torah with joy and excitement. That's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. That's an experiential misora. That's an experiential forming of consciousness, what it means to learn Torah. That it becomes something alive. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying, he's testifying. He's saluting his father at the gate, the entranceway to his book, and he's saying, my father's image appeared to me, right? Just like Joseph, and back in biblical times, it was the image of his father that saved him from sin. So Rav Soloveitchik is writing that it was his father's image that was able to shield him as he engaged the world, no matter where he was. It was his father's image and that joy, that experience, that life that he had with his father, that's what guided him at all times. That's the simple explanation Rav Soloveitchik is saying over here. Now, what I'm about to say, you can either take it or put it in the first wastebasket that you find. Because what I'm going to tell you over here is a personal musing, a personal thing that when I've been seeing this, this is what I think when I see this. Whether of Soloveitchik meant or not what I'm about to say, I don't know. But I could tell you, Be'emuna Shleima, that whether he meant everything or not, it could still be that it's emes. You know, you all know the famous thing, you learn a Rashi, there's like, 67,000, explanations in Rashi, and sometimes you ask yourself, oh, does Rashi really thought that? Did Rashi really think that when he said it? And the answer is, it could be that he didn't. But when you have Svarim, the real tzaddikim write, I'm talking about, of course, Svarim, they're written by Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh, but they're Rishonim, they're written with divine influence. So then, obviously, you could say interpretations that they themselves might not have been aware of. Latter generations might not have had open Ruach HaKodesh. They might not be openly divinely influenced. But I believe Emunah Shleima, and you can make fun of my belief, that's okay. I'm secure enough, you could do that. But I believe Emunah Shleima, that when you have real tzaddikim, when they write books, it might not be Ruach HaKodesh, but if the Baal Shem Tov taught that everything is Hashgacha Pratis, right? The Baal Shem Tov said that everything is divinely ordained. There's providence in everything. When a leaf falls from a tree, which direction it falls to the ground, God himself chooses. I believe Be'emunah Shleima that when a tzaddik writes a book, there are deeper interpretations in that also, whether he was aware of them or not. So I want to share with you how the Maggid of Mizrich explains this Gemara. And I mamish think that this is the shar, the gate into understanding, the way to understand what Rav Soloveitchik is going to do over here. There's a beautiful var from the Maggid of Mizrich, and it says like this. The Maggid taught. The Gemara says that Yosef was about to do an aveir, was about to sin with the wife of Potiphar. And then what does it say? Dmus diyukne shel aviv nira lo b'chalom. The image of his father was seen in the window. His father was Yaakov. The father of Yosef was Yaakov. Now you all know, if you have Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov is Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferes. Without getting too in detail, Tiferes means beauty. And the 10 Sfirot, the 10 attributes, are the 10 attributes that God enclothes himself in order to create a world. So Tiferes is when God encloses itself and contracts himself to manifest as beauty. And that's the Midah of Yaakov. God's divine beauty, the infinite beauty of Hashem is Tiferes. Says the Maggid, the wife of Potiphar, he's Medak, that the Medjur says that every day, Haisa mispa'eres lefanav, she would beautify herself in front of him. So Maggid says, now I should actually give an introduction over here before I should say what I'm about to say. Viewer's discretion is advised. Okay? I should say, hearer's discretion is advised. I'm going to learn with you now one of the most antinomian ideas of Hasidus, one of the ideas that the Talmid Baal Shem Tov taught, which is very dangerous. I feel comfortable saying it over here because I first heard it in Eish Kodesh. I remember when Rabbi Weinberger first taught these ideas in the very beginning, when I was a youngin, so it helped me throughout my life, and I feel therefore pleased to be able to share it further in these walls. I could tell you that this idea is very controversial, very revolutionary, this idea the Chassida says, to the extent that actually the Alter Rebbe in Tanya in chapter 28 says that it's not for regular people like us. The Alter Rebbe actually says that this idea from the students of the Baal Shem Tov that we're about to learn is not to be used by regular people like us. Only for the spiritual elite, for tzaddikim. There were many tzaddikim that didn't agree with the Alter Rebbe. The Kamarna, for instance, the Kamarna like has very sharp words. The Kamarna, if you heard the holy Kamarna that in Heichal HaBrocha, the Kamarna Rebbe, he actually ranks on the Alter Rebbe. He actually like is very angry at the Alter Rebbe. He says that I'm only allowed to say it because the Kamarna said it, but he says that the Kivyoch, that the Alter Rebbe didn't have enough faith in the Baal Shem Tov, right? That he should say that regular people can't say such a thing. That's how upset he was at the Alter Rebbe. And by the way, the Rebbe Rashab, the great grandson of the Alter Rebbe, was so upset at the Kamarna that he took his sefer out of his house. When he saw the Kamarna, that's the Bali Treason, right? The warriors. He was so upset that the Kamarna said that about the Alter Rebbe that he took the Kamarna sefer out of his house. But there was a matter of debate whether simple people like us could use this idea. But, okay, so I'm not going to take sides over here. You know, you'll decide on your own. Says the Magen Mizrach, Yosef saw the image of his father. He saw the divine beauty. He saw the image of his father, you know where? In the wife of Potiphar. She was the window. The Baal Shem Tov taught that all things in this world is the light of Hashem. And therefore, even things that manifest down here as things that we're not allowed to be involved in, even things that manifest in things that we're not allowed halachically to look at. So it's just the divine attribute that fell down in the mysterious shattering of the vessels, which we're not going to get into now, but the idea that the light of Hashem fell down and is now manifesting as this thing that one is forbidden to partake of. But it's still the light of Hashem. So the Maggid says, Dmus Yuknei Shalav Ivra, he saw his father's image, the Tiferes, he saw the beauty of Hashem in her. The Maggid says, you're not allowed to look at such things. But if, the Maggid says, a person chances upon some beauty, something that one is not allowed to look at, or some kind of music, or some kind of song, or anything in this world, you chance upon that is right now in the garment of impurity, says the Maggid, leave the garment. What did Yosef do? He left the garment in her hand. Vayonas v'yetze hachutza, says the Maggid, listen to the words. He says, he left the garment in her hand and ran out and was mizdabik and cleaved to his father, to Yisrael de la'ela, the supernal Yisrael, the supernal Yaakov. The mid of Tiferes, he saw the light of Hashem. He looked at her, and this is how he stopped himself from sinning, by being mizdabek, coming to a dveikus, that this is a lakus. This is the light. This is the light of Hashem. This is the divine beauty that's in over here. Agav, the Rebbe of Melech Mlezhensk, the Naim Ali Melech, in Parshas Beshalach, he takes a step further. He takes this idea from his Rebbe, from the Maggid, and he says, not only is Dmus Yuknoi, the image of his father, that he saw Yaakov, he saw the divine beauty in, she was the chaloin, she became that window. He actually saw his father, he saw God in that beauty. He says that image of his father was also that his father actually did that when he married Yosef's mother. That's what it means, that Yosef is yesoid. Yesoid means to connect, a connection. And he came, Yosef is Elo Todas Yaakov Yosef. Yosef is the continuation of what Yaakov began with Rachel. It's an extremely strange medrash. It says that when Yaakov came to the well, right, and Rachel was coming with the sheep, the Torah goes out of its way to say Rachel was Yefas Terv, Yefas Mar, that she was very beautiful. And then came Yaakov, and Vayishak Yaakov LeRachel. He kissed Rachel. And the Medrash says, if that's not, you know, picante enough, if that's not, you know, interesting enough, the Medrash says, Pasha, the Medrash says, his dabik, rotzel his dabik biyofia. He wanted to cleave to her beauty. That's why he kissed her. We're talking about Yaakov Avinu. It was a Merkava. It was a divine chariot. So the Rebbe Melech says that that's the idea. The same idea that he actually saw that beauty and Vayishak, he kissed heaven and earth. He came to a place of dveikus that he was able to take that beauty and kiss it and connect it with a lukus, with Hashem. He became such a merkava that he was able to draw down and see, show that this was the light of Hashem that was manifesting as this beauty over here. And Yosef continued that with Eishes Potiphar. Vayonas v'yetzah chutzah, he ran out of the garment, he left the garment, and he's connected to the light of Hashem that was in there. Now, obviously, as I said, the Maggid says that, you know, remember those commercials? Kids don't try this at home. Remember those things? You know, kids don't try this at home. This is trained. So obviously one has to be very careful. And the Maggid himself says that Chas v'Shalom, one can't elect to be involved in something forbidden and then find the godliness in that. There was a group of people that did. They were called Shabtai Tzvi, Derech Agav, Lahavdil. One can't elect to enter the realm of impurity, the realm of evil, and find godliness there. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to electively to do that voluntarily. But certainly what the Maggid says is that im nizdamen loy, if in front of you all of a sudden something beautiful comes in front of you, you should meditate on this. You should come to that state of dveikus, or what's machshava zara, an impure thought, etc., etc. Now you understand, when the walls of the ghetto fell, at the beginning of the 19th century, and the Jewish people all of a sudden were, you know, in the 19th century, caught within culture, worldly culture, there were a lot of different responses. And that struggle, how the Jewish people are supposed to cope with emancipation, and how we're supposed to be involved and engage the world, or to go out of the world, that is a matter of debate that is continuing to this day. I don't need to tell you. At every, you know, Aguda convention, or, you know, every Torah Masorah convention, or all the times this is being discussed in all the magazines, and, you know, some say we're winning the war, some say we're losing the war, but there are definitely a lot of different shitas, different ideas about how to go about engaging the world. Some, as I said, try to put up, you know, ghetto walls, and once again re-enter the ghetto. That worked for some until the internet. Today, I don't think anyone is managing. I think even, you know, in Meir Sharim, you know, you already have Wi-Fi. I have a friend of mine that tried. I believe, again, I don't know if Rav Soloveitchik consciously said this, but it definitely is hinting over here to the idea of the Maggid. Rav Soloveitchik was one that saw the beauty that philosophy and that the secular wisdom has to offer. He was definitely one that was fully engaged and that had a very clear view of the, all of a sudden, that the Chachma Begoyim Tamin, there is unbelievable knowledge and wisdom by the Gentiles. And Rav Soloveitchik was one that looked over there and saw godliness. He saw that as a window to the divine. And part of entering this book is being able to acknowledge, to fully acknowledge that yes, one is able, if one has this view of Eishes Potiphar, if one has a view of the world that we are privy to today, we have no choice but to be able, we don't have a choice, we can't make that ghetto anymore. We have to be able to use that as a vehicle to connect to Hashem. And that, I believe, is part of what he's saying over here. Part of understanding halachic man is being able to say, yes, I'm going to engage this secular wisdom, I'm going to engage this beauty that Chochma Begoyim has, and use it as a way to be able to see Yisrael de la'ela, to see the divine manifesting in that as well. Okay, so part one is halachic man, his worldview, and his life. Let's turn the page, let's begin. Chapter 1. Okay. Halachic man reflects, on the page, the other side of that same page. Turn the third, yeah. Halachic man reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. Do you feel the tension already? It's like, there's no like sweet, soft landing. He's like, he goes right for the jugular. So he doesn't leave you room to like feel calm. He right away like starts, you know, the conflict. Halachic man reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. On the one hand, he is as far removed from homo religiosus. Homo religiosus is Latin for religious man. We're going to speak, we're going to explain more. On the one hand, he is as far removed from homo religiosus as East is from West, and as identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. But on the other hand, he is a man of God, possessor of an ontological approach that is devoted to God and of a worldview saturated with the radiance of the divine presence. So right away, Rav Soloveitchik is doing over here is establishing three types of men. And that is the main majority of this book is going to be comparing, contrasting three types of men. Now you already see right away there's a footnote. The second word in the chapter, there's already a footnote, right? Halachic man, footnote one. So if you turn to the page, the page you have over there, there's, or if you have the book, in the back of the book, footnote one is on page 139. You all know what the word stereotypes means? You all know what stereotypes are, right? We're always taught, especially today's political correctness, that stereotypes are never true, and they're not right to make stereotypes, and that's true. Stereotypes are often not true. They're often not true, but a lot of times they are, right? I say this as a proud, pure-blooded Hungarian, 100% Hungari Tahor from all sides, all from my grandparents, that almost all the stereotypes they say about Hungarians is true about myself. I'm very confident and comfortable to say that. There's a reason there are stereotypes. Again, of course there are exceptions to the rule, and of course the derogatory ones are usually not nice to say, and many are often not true about most people, whatever. I'm not going to get too politically correct, but you know what I mean, right? So when we speak about types, so actually in the late 19th century that actually began a science. When psychology began being studied, there was a science of types. Look inside. So he says, again, Rav Soloveitchik is beginning the chapter by, and really the whole book, by introducing that there are three types of men that we're going to be discussing, three types of people that we're going to be discussing over here. So he says, obviously, the description of halachic man given here refers to a pure ideal type, as in the case with the other types with which the human sciences, Geistwissenschaften. Geistwissenschaften is a German word. Now, if anyone has heard anything about German philosophy, which, it's very sad today to admit, is probably the most beautiful philosophy of the past 200 years with the German philosophers. So much of German philosophy is built upon the idea, and later psychology, etc., and this human sciences, on the idea of Geist. Heard of the word Geist? Some people know from Poltergeist, right? Some say before Poltergeist, it comes from the same word. Geist. You know, Geist is translated as spirit. Geist is a spirit. But it doesn't. What spirit means, when you speak about, it became very popular in Germany, and unfortunately, it later on brought about the nationalism of Germany. Volkgeist. The spirit of a people. The collective consciousness of a people. When you speak about a person's Geist, you speak about like a person's mood, a person's way of thinking, right? A Geist is a spirit of what makes you tick. The Volkgeist is the stereotype, the type of the archetype. When you speak about archetypes, you speak about a Geist, understanding the spirit of a person. Geist, Wissenschaft is German for science. Wissenschaft. Geisteswissenschaften means human sciences, which became very popular to study the different types of peoples. And again, that brought about nationalism, especially in Germany, when we came discussing the absolute spirit and the different spirits of people, and that there's a collective consciousness among people and among nations and tribes, etc. So, in that human sciences, he says, there are, of course, the ideal types. He says, real halachic men, who are not simple but rather hybrid types, rather mixture types, approximate to a lesser or greater degree the ideal halachic man, each in accordance with his spiritual image and stature. Another, so Soloveitchik is saying as follows. He's saying that when we speak about types of people, he's going to make over here archetypes, these three archetypes that he's introducing of halachic man, religious man, and cognitive man. So he right away begins by saying that we have to understand that obviously he's talking here about types. And essentially, what is he conveying by this footnote over here? What's he essentially saying? What's he essentially coming to convey in this footnote? That all of us have a little of it, right? It's not black and white. We're not saying that there's one person that's only a halachic man and not a religious man and not a cognitive man. You know that in Judaism also, we have these idea of types, right? We have the idea of types. Where do we find this idea of types? No. Avram is chesed. Gvura. Yitzchak is gvura. What does that mean? Right? Avam is the attribute of chesed, of loving kindness, and Yitzchak is the attribute of severity. Does it mean that, you know, we speak about the Sheva Mid, the Sheva Royim, the seven shepherds, and each one had his own type. His own type means that this was Avram, his type was a type of chesed. Yitzchak's type was a type of gevurah. And you know, what are we told, you know, when you read that superficially, and then you're told that what do we have to do? All of them, right? It's not like multiple choice, right? Like, he gets to be chesed, and we have to, like, do all of them. How's that fair? Right? It's not like we have to learn from all of them. I don't know if it ever bothered you, you read Svarim that speaks about, you know, Dovid HaMelech did this and this, and Yosef was this, and so we have to be like them. But he was like him. He wasn't like someone else. So first of all, the answer is, why is it that we have to be like everyone? Why do we have to take up everyone's good traits? So first of all, you understand that that's what it means. Listen carefully, that they were the seven shepherds, the Shivaroyim. They're known as the Zohar, refers to them as the seven shepherds. What does that mean? That they actually give us these traits. They drew down to the world this trait. They were the first ones. Avram was a chariot. He was a Merkava of Midas HaChesed. Yitzchak was a chariot of Midas HaGevurah. And they give us the ability to go in their footsteps. That's first of all. So first of all, we're actually getting it from them. And second of all, of course, we're not asked to live up to the exact same thing as them. We're asked to have a little of it, right? To have a little chesed. It's interesting, you know, in Tanya, in chapter 42, the Alter Rebbe says, he brings what the Zohar says, how did Moshe Rabbeinu love God? Moshe Rabbeinu, the love that Moshe Rabbeinu loved God more than he loved his own life, more than life itself. He loved God to the extent that he was willing to do something for God, to the extent that you're willing to die. And you live with that love all the time. The Alter Rebbe says, so what does that mean to us? He was a great tzaddik. So he says, Efetz katseyu v'shemetz mineu. A little of a drop we have to have also. In other words, these types, we have to have a little in our lives also. By the way, it's Mamash this week's parsha. There's a beautiful idea that the Chassidus explains. I don't know if it ever bothered you. Remember, I think it was the first Rashi or the second Rashi, this week's parsha. It says, Eilu told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram hoyled us Yitzchak. These are the offspring of Yitzchak, the son of Avram. Avram gave birth to Yitzchak. No, what's the question in the pasuk? Seems to be repetitive. Eilu told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram gave birth to Yitzchak. That's the question. Why? You already said. Why does it have to say twice? So what does Rashi say? No, I don't remember. What does Rashi say? Leitzone Hador. Leitzone Hador, there were those scoffers of the generation, the clowns of the generation, right? They were making fun that all the years Avram and Sarah were living together and she never had children. All of a sudden she spent a couple of nights with Avimelech, and all of a sudden she's pregnant right away, gets pregnant with Yitzchak. So what does Rashi say? These are the words of Rashi. Ma asa kodesh baruch hu. What did God do? A great big miracle. What did he do? No? Sar cluster pun of Yitzchak, that Yitzchak should look like Avram. Is that such a big miracle? That a child should look like his father? What is Rashi says? Ma asa kodesh baruch hu. What did Hashem do? He did a huge miracle. Tsar cluster pun of Yitzchak, he made a miracle that Yitzchak should look like Avram. No, that's such a huge miracle. What's the big miracle of it? It very often happens that a child looks like his parent. It's not such a big chiddush. Huh? Well, that it doesn't say. That. Okay, that's interesting. That I never saw before. But Chassidus has an interesting answer. Chassidus says like this. We have a struggle between our body and our soul. Right? We have to worry about the fact that there's some kind of disparaging conflict that our soul and our body sometimes, you know, are dancing two different dances. Tzaddikim were chariots. Their bodies expressed the neshama completely. Their bodies didn't conceal at all their soul. Their bodies were conduits through which their soul was revealed openly. Now, if Avram was chesed and Yitzchak was gvura, they shouldn't have looked the same. To the extent that it actually, in a way, so you all know that Avram is an inin of chesed. And that's why who is the counterpart, or so to speak, the the bad result of what came out of Avram. What when Chesed goes bad, what happens? Yishmael is Chesed the Klipa, right? Bad love, right? Bad love, love that goes bad. Woodstock. Yitzchak, right? Yitzchak on the other end, he's Gvura, and when Gvura goes to the wrong extreme, then you have murder, then you have Esau. So B'chassida says that seemingly Yishmael was more like Avram than Yitzchak. Yishmael is Chesed, a Chesed the Klipa. Chesed of Klipa, impure Chesed. But Yitzchak is Mamash Gvura. And therefore should be that since the bodies are Mamash reflections of the soul, Avram and Yitzchak should not have looked together. They should not have looked the same. So Hashem made a big miracle and made that even so Yitzchak should look like Avram. He made that he should look like Chesed, right? By the way, parenthetically, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said a beautiful idea, which is very fitting for Lubavitcher Rebbe. He said, Hashem could have made a miracle so that Avram should look like Yitzchak. He could have made a miracle either way, right? So instead of making, he could have made Avram look like Yitzchak. No, he made Yitzchak look like Avram. Why that way and not that way? So he said like this, sometimes, you know, in life, you have to act in a way of Chesed. And sometimes life necessitates acting in a way of Gvura. Every parent knows that sometimes you have to act mean, right? You have to act mean, you have to act, sometimes you have to act kind, sometimes you have to act mean. What if you have a suffix? You have to pick one, you're not sure which. So it says, Hashem made Yitzchak look like Avram. Right? That way you know for sure, if you're not sure, act kindly, right? You're not sure which way to go, make it look like Chesed. That's your better way off. So man, that's the idea anyway. But that's the idea that Yitzchak and Avram, these types, we also believe in types. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik is saying over in the footnote. There's the pure ideal types. But then he said, that's the ideal types that no one exists like that. It doesn't mean that Avram was only Chesed. Even by Avram and Yitzchak, by the way, parenthetically, you know, even by these tzaddikim, even though Avram was Chesed, what do we all know? That when did Avram become a true Eved Hashem? Right? You all remember, what's the famous idea? By the Akedah. Ata yadati kir elikim ata. Now I know that you fear Hashem. The quintessential test for Avram was not that he was willing to give food for free to the wayfarers, to the Arab merchants, that he's able to show love. What's the ultimate test of Avram? That he's willing to act severely. His scholarliness, to be able to include, to be able to act a lot of different ways, right? And by the way, that means for us also, as Jews, we have to know any one particular way of acting to extreme is not good. You have to know how to be able to every midah. That's, by the way, Rabbi Sol Salanta says, that's why midahs, which we know means attributes, we try to develop good midahs, good attributes. What else does the word midah mean in Hebrew? Measurement. You have to know how to measure it. Everything has to be in its proper way. You have to know how to act each way in its proper way. And there, Hagav, I just got on a personal note, I just got to tell you, I remember when I was a youngin, when I was a bacher, so I'm still trying to find my way, that's the truth. But remember then I was, you know, as a true student of Rabbi Weinberger, so I was dabbling in everything. And I remember there were like, you know, there were tkufis that I was, you know, I was learning Chabad, and I was learning Breslev, and then the Satmar, Mungat, whatever I was. And, you know, I remember I went to the Amshin of a Rebbe, Shlita. Amshin of a Rebbe in Beit Vegan. Anyone knows it. If anyone wants to see a real McCoy tzaddik, like what they speak about, like Mamash Tzaddikim from that time, Amshin of a Rebbe, if anyone's seen this. He's even, could you imagine, he's even on YouTube. talk about seeing the image through a window, right? He managed, even Amshin of a Rebbe is on YouTube now. So I remember I went to him and I said to him that, you know, some days I feel, and also, I don't want to get into it, but I had theological issues also, because I was learning Nefesh HaChaim. I was very confused at the time. And I was saying that some days I'm like this, sometimes I'm like that. Amshin never said, it's okay. Amshin never said, whatever brings you closer to Hashem. So you need to, sometimes you need to do like this, sometimes you need to do like that. You know, it's, Hiskalos, we're not ideal types. Even Avram had to be Gvur sometimes. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're one way and that's it. Tell you a personal story. Remember one time, I'm not going to tell you the details of the story, but I remember one particular evening I had a very big crisis. And that time I was already very, very into Chabad. and went to Rebbe, to Rebbe Weinberger, to his house a night. It was an after-midnight visit, and I was very distraught, whatever. So as I was leaving, the last words he said to me, he says, he's like, Shmuel, he's like, tonight's a Breslov night, not a Chabad night. So we have to know this. Such that, you know, a person has to know we're not ideal. Whatever brings us close to Hashem, there are different types, and we have to know how to give and take, right? So anyways, Rav Soloveitchik is saying over here that there are these three types that this book is coming to address. And again, the three types that he's addressing over here is homoreligiosus, which is religious man. Then you have cognitive man, which is known as, so to speak, the prosaic cognitive man, which usually would be translated as a scientist. Right? The scientist would be cognitive man. Religious man, cognitive man, or so to speak, the empirical scientist. And halachic man, which he's saying is somewhere in between, that he's living in this world, that he has to be somewhere in between. He has to figure out, he has this crisis, and he has these two opposing selves that's going on within him. Now, I want to make a little introduction, but I know it's already late. Let's begin. We're going to continue next week. But just to begin over here now, I want to begin speaking about now, and we'll continue much more next week, but it's important already now at this point to say it. When we hear about these types of science, cognitive man, the scientist, as opposed to homoreligiosus, religious man, very often in our minds that resonates as that Rav Soloveitchik seems to be, which he's not, but it seems to be that he's speaking about the age-old debate between science and religion. Right? Because what's Rav Soloveitchik saying? The vast majority of this book is coming to explain three types. The scientist, cognitive man, religious man, and the third one, halachic man. So you have religious man and scientist, or so to speak, this debate between science and religion. So first of all, I want to tell you that's not what he means. And it's very important that I point that right away, and it's going to be very relevant as we go on. There is no such animal. There is no such debate between religion and science. It's one of the lies of modern society, and it didn't start now. It started in the Enlightenment. It started in 18th century France, that wanted to, after Sir Isaac Newton came and established a whole, Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton came and introduced a whole new way of appreciating science, which was against Aristotle and against the classic antiquated science, and really a whole new way of understanding knowledge. They began this, all the Enlightenment philosophers in France came along and said that there's a debate between science and religion. And to this day, unfortunately, there are so many people that have a hard time becoming religious and relating to God and the divine because they think that to be true to science means that you have to be against religion. Because science and religion don't go together. It's not true. It's a mistake that the Enlightenment philosophers took, and you know where they took it from? They took it from Christianity. The truth is that Christianity is guilty, and they themselves admit, the Christians also admit it, that the way the early Christian fathers themselves were guilty of making as if science and religion were polar opposites, and that came from an age-old debate between Plato and Aristotle. Really, the whole debate between science and religion, the way that Christianity brought it to today's modern society, comes from a debate between Plato and Aristotle, which we're going to need to understand further in the book. We're going to continue next week. Okay, we got two sentences done. And a footnote, right? I hope to go a little fast as we go along. That's for sure.
I saw the study that was told me the study at university that the question was, do you believe in God? If not, why not?
Uh-huh. So